but I'm able to take an extra day. I'll probably be here until the end of the week. Well, good luck, and thanks for the information. She turned and with hunched shoulders walked briskly back to St. John's Cottage. Watching her go, Emma told herself that it was just as well Karen hadn't wanted to stay longer. It would have been tempting to have talked over the murder with another woman and one of her own age. Tempting, but perhaps unwise. Karen might have questioned her about finding the Archdeacon's body, asked questions which it would have been awkward to parry. Everyone else at St. Anselm's had been scrupulous in their reticence, but somehow reticence wasn't a quality she associated with Karen Surtees. She walked on, puzzled. Of all the questions Karen might have wanted to ask, the one she had asked was the last that Emma would have expected. 5. It was 1:15 and Kate and Robbins had returned. Dalgleish saw that Kate, reporting precisely on their mission, was trying to keep the note of triumph and excitement out of her voice. She was always at her most detached and professional in moments of high success, but the enthusiasm was evident in her voice and in her eyes, and Dalgleish welcomed it. Perhaps he was getting back the old Kate, the Kate for whom policing had been more than a job, more than an adequate salary and the prospect of promotion, more than a ladder out of the mire of the deprivation and squalor of her childhood. He had hoped to see that Kate again. She had telephoned the news of the marriage as soon as she and Robbins had said their thank yous and goodbyes to Miss Fawcett. Dalgleish had instructed Kate to get a copy of the marriage certificate and return to St. Anselm's as soon as possible. A study of the map had shown that Clamstoke Lacey was only 14 miles away, and it had seemed reasonable first to try the church. But they had had no luck. St. Osyth's was now part of a team ministry, and there was at present an interregnum with a new priest temporarily taking the services. He was visiting one of the other churches, and his young wife knew nothing of the whereabouts of the parish registers, indeed seemed hardly to know what they were, and could only suggest that they waited for her husband to return. She expected him before supper, unless he was invited to have a meal with one of the parishioners. If this happened, he would probably telephone, although sometimes he was so preoccupied with parish concerns he forgot. The slight note of peevish resentment that Kate detected in her voice suggested that this was not an unusual occurrence. The best plan now seemed to be to try the register office in Norwich, and here they had more luck. A copy of the marriage certificate had been promptly produced. In the meantime, Dalgleish had telephoned Paul Perrinet in Norwich. There were two important questions to which he needed answers before they interviewed George Gregory. The first was the exact wording of Miss Arbuthnot's will. The second related to the provisions of an Act of Parliament on the date on which the legislation had come into force. Kate and Robbins hadn't waited to get themselves lunch, and now fell with eagerness upon the cheese rolls and coffee provided by Mrs. Pilbeam. Dalgleish said, "We can guess now how it was that Margaret Munro recalled the wedding. She had been writing her diary, dwelling on the past, and two images came together. Gregory on the shore taking off his left glove and feeling for Ronald Treve's pulse, and the page of bridal pictures in the Solebay Weekly Gazette. The fusion of death and life. Next day she telephoned Miss Fawcett, not from the cottage where she might have been disturbed, but from a telephone box in Lowestoft. She was given confirmation of what she must surely have suspected, the name of the bride. It was only then that she spoke to the person most concerned. There were only two people to whom those words could apply, George Gregory and Raphael Arbuthnot. And within hours of speaking and receiving reassurance, Margaret Munro was dead." Refolding the copy of the marriage certificate, he said, "We'll speak to Gregory in his cottage, not here. I'd like you to come with me, Kate. His car is here, so if he's out, he can't have gone far." Kate said, "But the marriage doesn't give Gregory a motive for the Archdeacon's murder. It should have taken place 25 years ago. Raphael Arbuthnot can't inherit. The will says he has to be legitimate according to English law. But that's exactly what the marriage makes him. Legitimate according to English law. Gregory could only just have returned. He opened the door to them wearing a black long-sleeved tracksuit and with a towel round his neck. His hair hung damply and the cotton clung to his chest and arms. Without standing aside to let them in, he said, "I was just about to shower. Is this urgent?" He was making them as unwelcome as importunate salesmen, and Dalgliesh for the first time saw in his eyes the challenge of an antagonism that he was making no attempt to conceal. He said, "It is urgent. May we come in?" Leading them through the study into the rear extension, Gregory said, "You have, Commander, something of the air of a man who feels that he is at last making progress. Some might say, about time. Let us hope it doesn't all end in the slough of despond." He motioned them to a sofa and sat himself at his desk, swiveling round the chair and stretching out his legs. He then began vigorously toweling his hair. Across the room, Dalgliesh could smell his sweat. Without taking the marriage certificate from his pocket, he said, "You married Clara Arbuthnot on 27 April 1988 at St. Osyth's Church, Clamstoke Lacey, Norfolk. Why didn't you tell me? Did you really believe that the circumstances of that marriage weren't relevant to the murder inquiry?" For a couple of seconds, Gregory was still and silent. But when he spoke, his voice was calm and unworried. Dalgliesh wondered whether he had, days ago, braced himself for this encounter. "I suppose by referring to the circumstances of the marriage, you've understood the significance of the date. I didn't tell you because I didn't think it was any of your business. That's the first reason. The second is that I promised my wife that the marriage would remain a secret until I had informed our son. And incidentally, Raphael is my son. The third is that I haven't yet told him, and I judged that the right moment to do so had not yet come. However, it looks as if you're forcing my hand." Kate said, "Does anyone at St. Anselm's know?" Gregory looked at her as if aware of her for the first time and deploring what he saw. "No one. Obviously they will have to know, and equally obviously they will blame me for keeping Raphael in the dark for so long. And them too, of course. Human nature being what it is, they'll probably find that more difficult to forgive. I can't see myself occupying this cottage for much longer. As I only took this job to get to know my son, and as St. Anselm's is doomed to close, that won't now matter. But I could wish to conclude this episode in my life more agreeably and in my own time." Kate asked, "Why the secrecy? Even the staff at the hospice were kept in the dark. Why bother to marry if no one was ever to be told?" "I thought I'd explained that. Raphael was to be told, but when I judged the moment to be right. I could hardly envisage being caught up in a murder investigation and having the police ferreting about in my private life. The moment still isn't right, but I suppose you'll have the satisfaction of telling him now." "No," said Dalgliesh. "That's your responsibility, not ours." The two men looked at each other. Then Gregory said, "I suppose you have some right to an explanation, or as close to one as I can get. You should know better than most men that our motives are rarely as uncomplicated and never as pure as they seem. We met at Oxford when I was her supervisor. She was an astonishingly attractive 18-year-old, and when she made it plain that she wanted an affair, I wasn't the man to resist. It was a humiliating disaster. I hadn't realized that she was confused about her sexuality and was deliberately using me as an experiment. She was unfortunate in her choice. No doubt I could have been more sensitive and imaginative, but I've never seen the sexual act as an exercise in acrobatic ingenuity. I was too young and perhaps too conceited to take sexual failure philosophically. And this was a spectacular failure. One can deal with most things, but not with frank disgust. I'm afraid I wasn't very kind. She didn't tell me that she was pregnant until it was too late for an abortion. I think she had tried to persuade herself that none of it was happening. She was not a sensible woman. Raphael inherits his looks, but not his intelligence, from his mother. There was no question of marriage. The idea of that commitment has horrified me all my life, and she made her hatred of me abundantly plain. She told me nothing about the birth, but did write later to say that a boy had been born, and that she had left him at St. Anselm's. After that, she went abroad with a woman companion, and we never met again. I didn't keep in touch with her, but she must have made it her business to know where I was. In early April 1988, she wrote to say that she was dying, and asked me to visit her in Ashcombe House Hospice outside Norwich. It was then that she asked me to marry her. The explanation she gave was that it was for the sake of her son. She had also, I believe, found God. It has been a tendency of the Arbuthnots to find God, usually at the time most inconvenient for their family. Kate asked again, "So why the secrecy?" She insisted on it. I made the necessary arrangements and merely called at the hospice, asking to take her for a drive. The nurse who had mainly looked after her was in on the secret and was the chief witness. There was some problem, I remember, about the second witness, but a woman visiting the hospice for an interview agreed to help. The priest was a fellow sufferer whom Clara had met at the hospice and who occasionally attended for what I think they call respite care. St. Osyth's at Clampstoke Lacey was his church. He obtained for us an archbishop's license, so no banns were necessary. We went through the prescribed form of words, and then I drove Clara back to the hospice. Clara wished me to keep the marriage certificate, and I still have it. She died 3 days later. The woman who'd nursed her wrote that she had died without pain and that the marriage had given her peace at the last. I'm glad that it made a difference to one of our lives. It had absolutely no effect on mine. She had asked me to break the news to Raphael when I judged the moment was right. Kate said, "And you waited 12 years? Did you ever intend to tell him?" "Not necessarily. I certainly didn't intend to burden myself with an adolescent son or to burden him with a father. I'd done nothing for him, taken no part in his upbringing. It seemed ignoble suddenly to present myself as if my purpose were to look him over and see if he were a son worth acknowledging." Dalgliesh said, "Isn't that, in effect, what you did?" "I plead guilty. I discovered in myself a certain curiosity, or perhaps it was the urging of those insistent genes. Parenthood is, after all, our only chance of vicarious immortality. I made discreet and anonymous inquiries and discovered that he went abroad for 2 years after university, then came back here and announced his intention of becoming a priest. As he hadn't read theology, he had to undertake a 3-year course. 6 years ago, I came here as a guest for a week. I later learned that there was a vacancy for a part-time teacher of ancient Greek and applied for the post." Dalgliesh said, "You know that St. Anselm's is almost certainly scheduled to be closed. After the death of Ronald Treves and the murder of the Archdeacon, that closure is likely to be sooner rather than later. You do realize that you have a motive for Crampton's murder? Both you and Raphael. Your wedding took place after the coming into force of the Legitimacy Act of 1976, which legitimized your son. Section 2 of the Act provides that where the parents of an illegitimate person marry one another and the father is domiciled in England or Wales, the person is rendered legitimate from the date of the marriage. I've checked on the exact wording of Miss Agnes Arbuthnot's will. If the college closes, everything it contains originally given by her is to be shared between the descendants of her father, either in the male or female line, provided they are practicing members of the Church of England and are legitimate in English law. Raphael Arbuthnot is the sole heir. Are you going to tell me you didn't know that? For the first time, Gregory showed signs that he was losing his careful mask of ironic detachment. His voice was peremptory. The boy doesn't know. I can see that this gives you a convenient motive for making me your chief suspect. Even your ingenuity can't produce a motive for Raphael. There were, of course, other motives than gain, but Dalgliesh didn't pursue them. Kate said, "We've only your word for it that he doesn't know he's the heir." Gregory got to his feet and towered over her. "Then send for him, and I'll tell him here and now." Dalgliesh intervened. "Is that either wise or kind? I don't bloody well care whether it is or it isn't. I'm not having Raphael accused of murder. Send for him, and I'll tell him myself. But first, I'm going to shower. I've no intention of presenting myself as his father, stinking of sweat." He disappeared into the body of the house, and they heard his footsteps on the stairs. Dalgliesh said to Kate, "Go to Nobby Clark and tell him we need an exhibit bag. I want that tracksuit. And ask Raphael to come here in 5 minutes' time." Kate said, "Is it really necessary, sir?"
"For his sake, yes it is.
Gregory is perfectly right. The only way to convince us that Raphael Arbuthnot is ignorant of his parentage is for us to be here when he's told." She was back with the exhibit bag within minutes. Gregory was still in the shower. Kate said, "I've seen Raphael. He'll be along in 5 minutes." They waited in silence. Dalgliesh glanced round at the ordered room and at the office seen through the open door. The computer on the desk facing the wall, the bank of grey filing cabinets, the bookcases with the leather tomes meticulously arranged. Nothing here was superfluous, nothing for ornament or show. It was the sanctum of a man whose interests were intellectual and who liked his life comfortable and uncluttered. Dalgliesh thought wryly that it was about to be cluttered now. They heard the door open, and Raphael came through the outer room and into the extension. Within seconds he was followed by Gregory, now wearing trousers and a navy blue, freshly ironed shirt, but with his hair still tousled. He said, "Perhaps we'd better all sit down." They did so. Raphael, puzzled, glanced from Gregory to Dalgliesh, but didn't speak. Gregory looked across at his son. He said, "There's something I have to tell you. This moment isn't of my choosing, but the police have taken more interest in my private concerns than I expected, so there's no choice. I married your mother on 27 April 1988. This was a ceremony you may feel should more appropriately have taken place 26 years ago. There's no way to say this without sounding melodramatic. I'm your father, Raphael." Raphael fixed his eyes on Gregory. He said, "I don't believe it. It isn't true." It was the usual commonplace response to shocking and unwelcome news. He said again, more loudly, "I don't believe it." But his face showed a different reality. The color drained from his brow, cheeks, and neck in a steadily retreating line, so visible that it looked as if the normal surge of the blood had been reversed. He got to his feet and stood very still, looking from Dalgliesh to Kate as if desperately seeking a denial. Even the muscles of his face seemed momentarily to sag, the incipient lines to deepen. And for a brief moment, Dalgliesh saw for the first time a trace of resemblance to his father. He had hardly time to recognize it before it was gone. Gregory said, "Don't be tedious, Raphael. Surely we can play this scene without recourse to Mrs. Henry Wood. I've always disliked Victorian melodrama. Is this the kind of thing I joke about? Commander Dalgliesh has a copy of the marriage certificate." "That doesn't mean you're my father." Your mother only had sex with one man in the whole of her life. I was he. I acknowledged my responsibility in a letter to your mother. For some reason, she required that small admission of folly. After our wedding, she gave me the correspondence between us. And then, of course, there is the DNA. The facts are unlikely to be challenged. He paused, then said, I'm sorry you find the news so repugnant. Raphael's voice was so cold that it was almost unrecognizable. And what happened? The usual story, I suppose. You fucked her, got her pregnant, decided you didn't care for the idea either of marriage or parenthood, and opted out? Not precisely. Neither of us wanted a child, and there was no possibility of marriage. I was the elder, and I suppose the more to blame. Your mother was only 18. Doesn't your religion rest on an act of cosmic forgiveness? So why not forgive her? You were better off with those priests than you would have been with either of us. There was a long silence. Then Raphael said, I would have been heir to St. Anselm's. Gregory looked at Dalgliesh, who said, You are the heir. Unless there's some legal quibble which I've overlooked. I've checked with the solicitors. Agnes Arbuthnot wrote in her will that if the college closed, all she had bequeathed to it should go to the legitimate heirs of her father, either in the male or female line, providing they were communicant members of the Church of England. She didn't write, born in wedlock. She wrote, legitimate in English law. Your parents married after the provisions of the 1976 Legitimacy Act came into force. That makes you legitimate. Raphael walked over to the southern window and stood silently looking out over the headland. He said, I'll get used to it, I expect. I got used to having a mother who dumped me like a bundle of unwanted clothes in a charity shop. I got used to not knowing the name of my father, or even if he were alive. I got used to being brought up in a theological college when my contemporaries had a home. I'll get used to this. At present, all I want is never to have to see you again. Dalgliesh wondered if Gregory had detected in his son's voice the quickly controlled quaver of emotion. Gregory said, No doubt that can be arranged, but not now. I imagine Commander Dalgliesh wants me to stay here. This exciting new information has given me a motive. You too, of course. Raphael turned on him. Did you kill him? No. Did you? God, this is ridiculous. He turned to Dalgliesh. I thought it was your job to investigate murder, not muck up people's lives. I'm afraid the two very often go together. Dalgliesh glanced at Kate, and together they walked towards the door. Gregory said, Obviously Sebastian Morel will have to be told. I prefer that you left that to me, or to Raphael. He turned to his son. Is that all right by you? Raphael said, I'll say nothing. Tell him whenever you like. It's a matter of supreme indifference to me. 10 minutes ago I didn't have a father. I haven't got one now. Dalgliesh asked Gregory, How long do you propose to wait? It can't be indefinite. It won't be, although after 12 years a week or so hardly seems significant. I'd prefer to say nothing until your investigation is complete, assuming that it ever is. But that's hardly practical. I'll tell him at the end of the week. I think I might be allowed to choose my own time and place. Raphael had already left the cottage, and through the great panes of glass, smudged by the sea mists, they could see him striding over the headland towards the sea. Looking after him, Kate said, Will he be all right? Shouldn't someone go after him? Gregory said, He'll survive. He's not Ronald Treves. For all his self-pity, Raphael has been indulged all his life. My son is fortified by a core of healthy self-regard. When Nobby Clark was summoned to take possession of his tracksuit, He made no difficulty about handing it over, and watched with sardonic amusement as it was placed in a plastic bag and labelled, before seeing Dalgliesh, Kate and Clark out of the cottage as formally as if he were saying good-bye to esteemed guests. They made their way toward St. Matthew's. Kate said, "It's a motive. I suppose Gregory has to be our chief suspect, but it doesn't really make sense, does it? I mean, it's obvious this place is going to be closed down. Raphael would have inherited anyway in the end. There wasn't any hurry." Dalgliesh said, "But there was. Think about it, Kate." He gave no explanation, and Kate knew better than to ask. They had reached St. Matthew's cottage when Piers appeared at the door. He said, "I was just going to ring you, sir. We've had a call from the hospital. Inspector Yarwood is well enough to be interviewed. They suggest we leave it until tomorrow morning, when he'll be more rested." Six. All hospitals, thought Dalgliesh, whatever their situation or architecture, are essentially alike. The same smell, the same paint, the same notices directing visitors to wards and departments, the same inoffensive pictures in the corridors, chosen to reassure, not to challenge, the same visitors with their flowers and packages, making their confident way to familiar bedsides, the same staff in a variety of uniforms and half-uniforms, moving purposefully in their natural habitat, the same tired, resolute faces. How many hospitals had he visited since his days as a detective constable, keeping watch over prisoners or witnesses, taking deathbed statements, questioning medical staff with more immediate things on their minds than his preoccupations? As they approached the ward, Piers said, "I try to keep out of these places. They give you infections that they can't cure. And if your own visitors don't exhaust you to death, other patients' visitors will. You can never get enough sleep, and the food's inedible." Looking at him, Dalgliesh suspected that the words hid a deeper repugnance, amounting almost to a phobia. He said, "Doctors are like the police. You don't think about them until you need them, and then you expect them to work miracles. I'd like you to stay outside while I speak to Yarwood, at least initially. If I need a witness, I'll call you in. I'll have to take this gently." A houseman, looking ridiculously young and with the customary stethoscope round his neck, confirmed that Inspector Yarwood was fit now to be interviewed and directed them to a small side ward. Outside, a uniformed police constable was keeping watch. He got up smartly as they approached and stood to attention. Dalgliesh said, "DC Lane, isn't it? I don't think you'll be needed once it's known that I've spoken to Inspector Yarwood. You'll be glad to get away, I expect." "Yes, sir. We are pretty short-staffed." Who isn't, thought Dalgliesh. Yarwood's bed was positioned to give him a view of the window and over the regulated roofs of suburbia. One leg suspended on a pulley was in traction. After their encounter in Lowestoft, they had met only once and briefly at St. Anselm's. Dalgliesh had been struck then by the look of weary acceptance in the man's face. Now he seemed bodily to have shrunk, and the weariness to have deepened into defeat. Dalgliesh thought, hospitals take over more than the body. No one exerts power from these narrow, functional beds. Yarwood was diminished in spirit as in size, and the darkened eyes turned on Dalgliesh held a look of puzzled shame that malignant fate should have laid him so low. It was impossible to avoid the first banal question as they shook hands. "How are you feeling now?" Yarwood avoided a direct answer. "If Pilbeam and the lad hadn't found me when they did, I'd have been a goner. An end of feeling, an end to claustrophobia. Better for Sharon, better for the kids, better for me. Sorry to sound such a wimp. In that ditch, before I became unconscious, there was no pain, no worry, just peace.
It wouldn't have been a bad way to go. The truth is, Mr. Dalglish, I wish they'd left me there.
I don't. We've had enough deaths at St. Anselm's. He didn't say that now there had been another. Yarwood stared out over the rooftops. No more trying to cope, and no more feeling such a bloody failure. Searching for the words of comfort, which he knew he couldn't find, Dalglish said, "You have to tell yourself that whatever hell you're in at present, it won't last forever. Nothing ever does. But it could get worse. Difficult to believe, but it could. Only if you let it." There was a pause. Then Yarwood said with an obvious effort, "Point taken. Sorry I let you down. What happened exactly? I know that Crampton's been murdered, but nothing else. You've managed so far to keep the details out of the national papers, and the local radio only gave the bare facts. What happened? I suppose you came for me after you discovered the body and found I'd gone. Just what you needed. A murderer on the loose, and the one man you could look to for a spot of professional help doing his best to qualify as a suspect. It's odd, but I just can't work up any interest in it. I just can't make myself care. Me, who used to be branded an overzealous officer. I didn't kill him, by the way." "I didn't think you did. Crampton was found in the church, and the facts so far suggest he was lured there. If you'd wanted a bloody encounter, you'd only have had to go next door. But that's true of everyone in college. The killer wanted to incriminate St. Anselm's. The archdeacon was intended as the chief, but not the only victim. I don't think you feel like that." There was a pause. Yarwood shut his eyes, then shifted his head restlessly on the pillow. He said, "No, I don't feel like that. I love that place. And now I've spoiled that, too." "It's not so easy to spoil St. Anselm's. How did you meet the fathers?"
"It was about 3 years ago. I was a sergeant then, new to the Suffolk force. Father Peregrine had backed into a lorry on the Lowestoft Road. No one was hurt, but I had to interview him. He's too absent-minded to be a safe driver, and I managed to persuade him to stop. I think the fathers were grateful. Anyway, they never seemed to mind when I started turning up. I don't know what it was about the place, but I felt different when I was there. When Sharon left me, I began driving over for Sunday morning mass. I'm not religious, and I really hadn't a clue what was going on. It didn't seem to matter. I just liked being there. The fathers have been kind to me. They don't pry, they don't invite confidences, they just accept. I've had it all. Doctors, psychiatrists, counselors, the lot. St. Anselm's was different. No, I wouldn't harm them. There's a police constable outside this room, though, isn't there? I'm not stupid. A bit crazy, but not stupid. It's my leg that got broken, not my head. He's there for your protection. I'd no way of knowing what you'd seen, what evidence you might be able to give. Someone could have wanted you out of the way. A bit far-fetched, isn't it? I preferred not to risk it. Can you remember what happened on Saturday night? Yes, until I actually lost consciousness in the ditch. The walk against the wind is a bit hazy. It seems to have lasted a shorter time than it did, but I remember the rest of it, most of it anyway. Let's start from the beginning. What time did you leave your room?
About 12:05. The storm woke me. I'd been dozing but not sleeping soundly. I switched on my light and looked at my watch. You know how it is when you're having a bad night. You lie there hoping that it's later than you think, that it'll soon be morning. And then the panic struck. I tried to fight it. I lay there sweating, rigid with terror. I had to get out of the room, out of Gregory, away from St. Anselm's. It would have been the same wherever I was. I must have put on a coat over my pajamas and my shoes without waiting to put on socks.
I can't remember that bit. The wind didn't worry me much. In a way, I think it helped. I'd have walked out even into a blizzard and 20 feet of snow. God, I wish I had. How did you leave?
By the iron gate between the church and Ambrose. I've got a key. All the visitors are given up, but you know that.
Dalglish said, we found the gate locked. Do you remember locking it after you?
I must have done, mustn't I? It's the sort of thing I'd do automatically.
Did you see anyone near the church?
No one. The courtyard was empty.
And you didn't hear anything, see any lights? See the door of the church open, for example?
I heard nothing but the wind, and I don't think there was a light in the church. If there was, I didn't see it. I think I'd have noticed if the door had been wide open, but not if it had just been ajar. I did see someone, but not near the church. It was earlier, just when I was passing the front door of Ambrose. It was Eric Surtees. But he was nowhere near the church. He was in the north cloister letting himself into the house.
Didn't that strike you as strange?
Not really. I can't describe what I felt at that moment. Breathing in that great rushing air. The sense of being outside the walls. If I'd thought about Surtees at all, I suppose I'd have taken it for granted that he'd been called in to cope with some domestic emergency. He is the handyman, after all.
After midnight, in the middle of a storm.
There was a silence between them.
It was interesting, thought Dalglish, how his questioning, so far from worrying Yarwood, seemed to have lifted his spirits and deflected his mind, at least temporarily, from the weight of his own troubles.
Now, Yarwood said, he's an unlikely murderer, isn't he? A gentle, unassuming, useful kind of chap. He had no reason to hate Crampton, as far as I know.
Anyway, he was letting himself into the house, not into the church. What was he doing if he wasn't on call?
Perhaps collecting the keys to the church. He had nowhere to find them.
A bit foolhardy, wouldn't it be? And why the hurry? Wasn't he supposed to be painting the sacristy on Monday? I think I heard Pilby mention it, and if he'd wanted a key, why not take it earlier?
He could move about the main building as he chose.
That would have been riskier. The ordinant who prepared the church for the service would have noticed that one set of keys was missing.
All right, I'll give you that, sir. But the same argument applies to Surtees as it does to me. If he'd wanted to pick a fight with Crampton, he knew where to find him. He knew that the door of Augustine would be open.
You're sure it was Surtees?
Sure enough to swear to it in court if necessary.
It was after midnight, and you were in a pretty bad state.
It was Surtees. I've seen him often enough. The lights in the cloisters are dim, but I couldn't be mistaken.
I'd maintain that in court under cross-examination, if that's what you're asking.
Not that it would do much good.
I can hear defending counsel's final address to the jury. Poor visibility, figure seen only for a second or two, witness a deeply disturbed man crazy enough to walk out into a raging storm. And then, of course, the evidence that, unlike Surtees, I disliked Crampton.
But now Yarwood was beginning to tire. His sudden spurt of interest in the murder inquiry seemed to have exhausted him. It was time to go, and with this new information Dalglish was anxious to leave. But first he must be sure there was nothing more to learn. He said, we'll need a statement, of course, but there's no great urgency.
By the way, what do you think brought on your panic attack?
The quarrel with Crampton after tea on Saturday.
You've heard about that?
Well, of course you would.
I didn't expect to see him at St. Anselm's, and I imagine it was just as much of a shock for him.
And I didn't start the row. He did. He just stood there spitting the old accusations at me. He was shaking with anger, like a man in some kind of fit. It goes back to the death of his wife. I was a detective sergeant then, and it was my first murder case.
Murder? He killed his wife, Mr. Dalglish. I was sure of it at the time, and I'm sure now. Okay, I was overzealous. I made a cock-up of the whole inquiry. In the end, he complained of harassment, and I was reprimanded. It did my career no good. I doubt I'd have made Inspector if I'd stayed with the Met, but I'm as sure now as I was then that he killed her and got away with it. On what evidence? There was a bottle of wine by her bed. She died from an overdose of aspirin and alcohol. The bottle had been wiped clean. I don't know how he got her to take a whole bottle of tablets, but I'm damn sure he did. And he was lying. I know he was lying. He said he never went up to the bed. He did a bloody sight more than that. Doug Lee said he could have been lying about the bottle and about not approaching the bed. That doesn't make him a murderer. He could have found her dead and panicked. People behave oddly under stress. Yarwood reiterated obstinately. He killed her, Mr. Dalgleish. I saw it in his face and in his eyes. He was lying. That doesn't mean I took the opportunity to avenge her. Is there anyone who might? Had she close relations, siblings, a former lover? No one, Mr. Dalgleish. Just her parents, and they didn't strike me as being particularly sympathetic. She never got justice, and nor did I. I'm not sorry Crampton's dead, but I didn't kill him. And I don't think I'll care over much if you never discover who did. Dalgleish said, but we shall. And you're a police officer. You can't really believe what you just said. I'll be in touch. Keep what you've told me to yourself. But you know all about discretion. Do I? I suppose so. It's difficult to believe now that I'll ever get back on the job. He turned his face away in a gesture of deliberate rejection. But there was one final question Dalgleish needed to ask. He said, did you discuss your suspicions about the Archdeacon with anyone at St. Anselm's? No. It wasn't the kind of talk they'd have wanted to hear. Anyway, it was all in the past. I never expected to see the man again. They'll know now. That is, if Raphael Arbuthnot bothers to tell them. Raphael? He was in the South Cloister when Crampton tackled me. Raphael heard every word.
7. They had driven to the hospital in Dalgleish's Jaguar. Neither he nor Piers spoke while they buckled themselves into their seats, and they had thrown off the eastern suburbs of the city before Dalgleish briefly reported what he had learned. Piers listened in silence, then said, I can't see Surtees as a killer. But if he did do it, he wouldn't have been alone. His sister would have had a hand in it somehow. I can't believe anything happened at St. John's Cottage on Saturday night that she didn't know about. But why should either of them want Crampton dead? Okay, so they probably knew he was hell-bent on getting St. Anselm's closed down at the first opportunity. That wouldn't have suited Surtees. He seems to have set himself up very nicely with his cottage and his pigs, but he wasn't going to stop closure by killing Crampton. And if he had a private quarrel with the man, why bother to set up an elaborate scheme to lure him into the church? He knew where Crampton was sleeping. He must have known, too, that the door was unlocked. Dalgleish said, so did everyone in the college, including the visitors. Whoever killed Crampton wanted to make sure that we'd know it was an inside job. That much was apparent from the beginning. There's no obvious motive for either Surtees or his half-sister. If we're considering motive, George Gregory has to be prime suspect. None of that needed reiterating, and Piers wished he'd kept his mouth shut. He had learned that when A.D. was in one of his silent moods, it was sensible to stay quiet, particularly if one had nothing original to contribute. Back at St. Matthew's Cottage, Dalgleish decided to interview the two Surteeses with Kate. 5 minutes later, escorted by Robbins, they arrived. Karen Surtees was shown into the waiting room and the door firmly closed. It was apparent that Eric Surtees had been mucking out the piggery when Robbins arrived to summon him, and he brought into the interview room a strong but not disagreeable smell of earth and animal. He had taken time only to wash his hands, and now sat with them lying side by side, knuckles clenched in his lap. They were held with such controlled stillness that they seemed curiously at odds with the rest of his body, reminding Dalgliesh of two small animals curled in petrified fear. He would have had no time to consult his sister, and his backward glance at the door as he came in betrayed his need for her presence and support. Now he sat in unnatural stillness. Only his eyes moved from Dalgliesh to Kate and back again, then settled on Dalgliesh. Dalgliesh was experienced in recognizing fear, and he didn't misinterpret. He knew that it was often the innocent who were the most obviously frightened. The guilty, once they had concocted their ingenious story, were eager to tell it. Borne through their interrogation by a surge of hubris and bravado which could sweep before it any embarrassing manifestations of guilt or fear. He wasted no time on formalities. He said, "When my officers questioned you on Sunday, you said that you hadn't left St. John's Cottage during Saturday night. I shall now ask you again. Did you go either to the college or to the church after Compline on Saturday?" Surtees gave a quick glance at the window, as if it offered escape, before again willing himself to meet Dalgliesh's eyes. His voice sounded unnaturally high. "No, of course not. Why should I?" Dalgliesh said, "Mr. Surtees, you were seen by a witness entering St. Anselm's from the North Cloister just after midnight. There can be no doubt about the identification." "It wasn't me. It must have been someone else. Nobody could have seen me, because I wasn't there. It's a lie." The confused denial must have sounded unconvincing, even to Surtees' ears. Dalgliesh said patiently, "Mr. Surtees, are you asking to be arrested for murder?" Surtees seemed visibly to shrink. He looked little more than a boy. There was a long pause, then he said, "All right, I did go back to the college. I woke up and saw a light in the church, so I went to investigate." "At what time did you see this light?" "At about midnight, like you said. I got up to go to the lavatory, and that's when I saw it." Kate spoke for the first time. "But the cottages are all built to the same plan. The bedrooms and bathrooms are at the back. In your cottage, they face northwest. How could you have seen the church?" Surtees licked his lips. He said, "I was thirsty. I went down to get a cup of water and saw the light from the sitting room. At least I thought I saw it. It was only faint. I thought I'd better investigate." Dalgliesh said, "Didn't you think to wake your sister or telephone Mr. Pilbeam or Father Sebastian? Surely that would be the natural thing to do." "I didn't want to disturb them," Kate said. "Pretty courageous of you, venturing out alone on a stormy night to confront a possible intruder. What were you planning to do when you got to the church?" "I don't know. I wasn't thinking very clearly." Dalgliesh said, "You're not thinking very clearly now, are you? However, go on. You say you went over to the church. What did you find?" "I didn't go in. I couldn't, because I hadn't got a key. The light was still on. I let myself into the house and fetched one of the keys from Miss Ramsay's office, but when I returned to the North Cloister, the light in the church had gone out." He was speaking more confidently now, and the clenched hands visibly relaxed. It was Kate who, after a brief glance at Dalgliesh, took over the questioning. "So what did you do then?" "I didn't do anything. I thought I must have been mistaken about the light." "But you seemed quite certain about it earlier. Otherwise, why venture out into the storm? First a light is on, and then mysteriously it's switched off. Didn't it occur to you to go into the church to investigate? That was your purpose, wasn't it, in leaving the cottage?" Surtees mumbled,
It didn't seem necessary. Not when there wasn't a light anymore. I told you I thought I'd been mistaken.
He added, I did try the sacristy door, and it was locked, so I knew that no one was in the church.
After the archdeacon's body was found, one of the three sets of church keys was discovered to be missing.
How many sets were in place when you took the keys?
I can't remember. I didn't notice. I was just anxious to get out of the office. I knew exactly where the church keys were on the keyboard, and I just took the nearest pair.
And you didn't return them?
No. I didn't want to go into the house again.
Dalgleish interposed quietly.
In that case, Mr. Surtees, where are those keys now?
Kate had seldom seen a suspect more broken by terror. The brave spirit of hope and confidence which had been apparent during the early part of the questioning drained away, and Surtees slumped forward in the chair, his head bowed and his whole body shaking.
Dalgleish said, I'm going to ask you once again. Did you go into the church on Saturday night?
Surtees managed to sit upright and even to meet Dalgleish's eyes. And now it seemed to Kate that terror was giving way to relief. He was about to tell the truth and was glad to put an end to the prolonged ordeal of lying. Now he and the police would be on the same side. They would approve of him, absolve him, tell him that they understood. She had seen it all so many times before.
Surtees said, All right, I did go into the church, but I didn't kill anybody. I swear I didn't. I couldn't. I swear before God that I never touched him. I was only there for less than a minute.
Dalgleish asked, Doing what?
I was getting something for Karen, something she needed. It was nothing to do with the Archdeacon. It's private between us.
Kate said, Mr. Surtees, you must know that that isn't good enough. Nothing is private in a murder investigation. Why did you go to the church on Saturday night?
Surtees looked at Dalgleish, as if willing him to understand.
Karen needed another consecrated wafer.
It had to be consecrated. She asked me to get one for her.
She asked you to steal for her?
She didn't see it like that.
There was a silence. Then he said,
Yes, I suppose so. But it wasn't her fault, it was mine. I didn't have to agree. I didn't want to do it. The fathers have always been good to me, but it was important to Karen, and in the end I said I'd go. She had to have it this weekend, because she needs it on Friday. She just didn't think it was all that important. It was just a wafer to her. She wouldn't have asked me to steal something valuable.
Dalgleish said, But this was something valuable, wasn't it?
Again there was a silence.
Dalgleish said, Tell me what happened on Saturday night. Think back and think clearly. I want every detail.
Surtees was calmer now. He seemed almost physically to be drawing himself up, and the colour was again blotching his cheeks. He said, I waited until very late. I had to be sure they would all be asleep, or at least in their rooms. And the storm was a help. I didn't think they'd be going for a walk. It was about 1:45 when I started out.
Wearing?
Just my dark brown corduroys and a thick leather jacket. No light clothes. We thought it would be safer to wear dark clothes, but I wasn't disguised.
Did you wear gloves?
No.
I didn't think it was necessary. I've only got thick gardening gloves and an old woolen pair. I'd have had to take them off to pick up the wafer, cope with the locks, and I didn't think it mattered not wearing gloves. No one would know there had been a theft. They wouldn't miss one wafer. They'd think they'd miscounted. That's what I argued.
I've just got the two keys, one to the iron gate and the other to the door from the north cloister. Usually I don't need them during the day, as the gate and the doors from both the cloisters are left open. I knew that the church keys were in Miss Ramsay's office. Sometimes at festivals like Easter, I'll give them flowers or greenery. Father Sebastian would ask me to leave them in a bucket of water in the sacristy. There's always one of the students who's good at decorating the church,
Sometimes Father Sebastian hands me the keys, or he tells me to get them from the office, lock up carefully after me and return them. We're supposed to sign for the church keys if we take them, but sometimes people don't bother. They made it very easy for you, didn't they? But then it isn't difficult to steal from people who trust you. There was a second when Dalgleish was simultaneously aware of the note of contempt in his voice and of Kate's unspoken surprise. He told himself that this was too close to personal involvement. Surtees said, with more confidence than he had shown before, "I wasn't going to hurt anyone. I couldn't hurt anyone. And even if I'd managed to steal the wafer, no one at the college would have been hurt. I don't think they'd even have known. It was just one wafer. It wouldn't have cost more than a penny." Doug Lee said, "So let's get back to what exactly happened on Saturday night. We'll leave out the excuses and justification. We'll stick to the facts. All the facts. Well, as I said, it was about 11:45 when I set out. The college was very dark and the wind was howling. There was only one light, and that was in one of the guest rooms, and the curtains were drawn. I used my key to get into the college through the back door, then past the scullery and into the main part of the house. I had a torch with me, so I didn't need to put on any of the lights, but there was one light burning beneath the statue of the Madonna and Child in the main hall. I had a story ready if anyone appeared. I was going to say that I thought I'd seen a light from inside the church and was coming to get the keys to investigate. I knew it would sound unconvincing, but I wasn't really expecting to have to use it. I took the keys and went out again the way I'd come in, locking the door behind me. I put out the cloister lights and kept close to the wall. There wasn't any trouble with the mortise lock to the sacristy. It's always kept oiled and the key turned very easily. I pushed open the door very gently, lighting my way with the torch, and turned off the alarm system. I was beginning to feel less frightened and more optimistic. It had all gone so easily. I knew where the wafers would be, of course, to the right of the altar in a kind of alcove with a red light shining above it. They keep consecrated wafers there in case one of the priests has to take them out to someone who is sick in the community, or sometimes they're taken to a communion service at one of the village churches where they don't have a priest. I had an envelope in my pocket, and I was going to put the wafer inside, but when I pushed open the door into the church, I saw there was someone there. It wasn't empty. Again he paused. Dalgleish resisted temptation to comment or question. Surtees had his head bowed, his hands clasped in front of him. He looked as if remembering had suddenly become an effort. He said, "There was a light on at the north end of the church. The light over the doom, and there was someone standing there, a figure in a brown cloak and hood." It was Kate who couldn't resist the question. "Did you recognize him?" "No. He was partly behind a pillar, and the light was too dim, and the hood was up over his head." "Tall or short?" "I think about average. Not particularly tall. I can't really remember. And then in the minute while I watched, the big south door opened, and someone came in. I didn't recognize him either. I didn't really see him. I just heard him call out, 'Where are you?' And then I shut the door. I knew the whole thing was off. There was nothing for it but to lock up after me and go back to the cottage." Dalgleish said, "Are you absolutely certain that you recognized neither of the figures?" "Quite certain. I never saw either face. I didn't really see the second man at all."
"But you know it was a man?"
"Well, I heard the voice." Dalgleish said, "Who do you think it was?" "Judging from the voice, I think it might have been the Archdeacon."
"So he must have spoken quite loudly."
Surtees flushed. He said unhappily, "I suppose it must have been quite loud. It didn't seem so at the time. Of course, the church was very quiet and the voice sort of echoed.
I can't be certain it was the Archdeacon. It's just the impression I had at the time. It was apparent he could tell them nothing more certain about the identity of either figure. Dalgliesh asked him what he had done after leaving the church. I reset the alarm, locked the door behind me, and went out through the courtyard, past the south door of the church. I don't think it was open or even ajar. I can't remember seeing a light, but I wasn't really noticing. I was just anxious to get away. I battled my way across the headland against the wind and told Karen what had happened. I was hoping I'd have a chance to return the keys sometime on Sunday morning, but when we were sent for to go to the library and were told about the murder, I knew it wouldn't be possible. So what did you do with them? Sertie said miserably. I buried them in a corner of the pig pen. Dalgliesh said, when this interview is over, Sergeant Robbins will go with you to recover them. Surtees made to get up, but Dalgliesh said, I said when the interview is over. It isn't over yet. The information they had just gained was the most important they'd been given so far, and he had to resist the temptation to follow it up at once. First, it was necessary to get what confirmation he could of Surtees' story. 8. Summoned by Kate, Karen Surtees came into the room with no apparent sign of nervousness. Seated herself beside her half-brother, without waiting for Dalgliesh's invitation, hitched her black shoulder bag onto the back of the chair, and turned immediately towards Surtees. You all right, Eric? No third degree? Yes, I'm all right. I'm sorry, Karen. I've told them. He said again, I'm sorry. What for? You did your best. It wasn't your fault. It was someone in the church. You tried. Just as well for the police that you did. I hope they're grateful. Surtees' eyes had brightened at the sight of her, and there was an almost palpable sense of her fortifying strength passing through him as she briefly laid her hand on his. His words had been apologetic, but there had been nothing servile in the look he gave her. Dalgliesh recognized the most dangerous of complications. Love. And now she turned her attention to him, fixing on him a concentrated and challenging gaze. Her eyes widened, and he thought she was suppressing a secretive smile. Dalgliesh said, Your brother has admitted that he was in the church on Saturday night. Early Sunday morning. It was after midnight, and he's my half-brother, same dad, different mothers. Dalgliesh said, So you told my officers earlier. I've heard his story. I'd like to hear yours. It'll be much the same as Eric's. He's not much good at lying, as you've probably discovered. That can be inconvenient at times, but it has its advantages. Well, it's no great deal. He hasn't done anything wrong, and the idea that he could hurt anyone, let alone kill them, is ridiculous. He can't even kill his own pigs. I asked him to get me a consecrated wafer from the church. If you don't go in for these things, I can tell you that they're small white discs made, I imagine, of flour and water, about the size of a two-penny piece. Even if he'd managed to get one and been caught, I can't see the magistrates committing him to the Crown Court for sentence. Value? Insignificant. Dalgliesh said, It depends on your scale of values. Why did you want it? I don't see what that has to do with your present inquiry, but I don't mind telling you. I'm a freelance journalist, and I'm writing an article on the Black Mass. He's been commissioned, by the way, and I've done most of the research. The people I've succeeded in infiltrating need a consecrated wafer, and I promise to get one. And don't say that I could have bought a whole box of unconsecrated wafers for a quid or two. That was Eric's argument. This is genuine research, and I needed the genuine article. You may not respect my job, but I take it as seriously as you take yours. I'd promised to provide a consecrated wafer, and that was what I was going to do. The research would have been a waste of time otherwise.
So you persuaded your half-brother to steal it for you?
Well, Father Sebastian wasn't going to give me one if I asked nicely, was he?
Your brother went alone?
Of course.
No sense in my tagging along and adding to the risk. At a pinch, he could justify being in the college. I couldn't.
But you did wait up for him.
It wasn't a question of waiting up. We'd never actually been to bed, at least not to sleep.
So you heard his account of what happened immediately he got back, not next morning?
He told me as soon as he got back. I was waiting and he told me.
Miss Surtees, this is very important. Please think back and try to remember exactly what you were told, and in your brother's words.
I don't think I can remember the exact words, but the sense was plain enough.
He told me he'd had no problem in getting the key. He opened the sacristy door by the light of his torch, and then the door leading into the church. It was then he saw the light over that oil painting opposite the main door, the doom, isn't it? And a figure standing close to it wearing a cloak and hood. Then the main door opened and someone else came in. I asked him if he recognized either figure, and he said he didn't. The one in the cloak had the hood up and his back to him, and he only had a brief glimpse of the second man. He thought that the second figure called out, "Where are you?" or something like that. The impression he got was that it could have been the Archdeacon.
And he didn't suggest to you at all who the other figure might have been?
No.
But he wouldn't, would he? I mean, he didn't think there was anything sinister about seeing a cloaked figure in the church. It mucked things up for us, and it was odd at that time of night, but he naturally assumed that it was one of the priests or one of the students.
I assume the same. God knows what they would do in there after midnight. They could have been having their own black mass for all we cared.
Obviously, if Eric had known the Archdeacon was going to be murdered, he'd have taken more notice.
At least I suppose he would.
What do you think you'd have done, Eric, faced with a murderer with a knife?
Surtees looked at Dalglish as he replied.
Run away, I suppose. I'd have raised the alarm, of course. The guest sets aren't locked, so I'd probably have rushed into Jerome for your help.
At the time, I was just disappointed that I'd managed to get the key without being seen, and it was beginning to seem so easy, and now I'd have to go back and say I failed.